Jonathan, Robin, Ken, Starlet, Steve, and Frank is what I've got.
Sounds good to me.
Okay, great.
We good to go, Craig?
Yeah, I think we're good.
Okay, this is the 9/11 Truth Teleconference, 4/12/2612. Welcome, everybody. Let's see, our first item on the agenda, as always, is to review, to affirm the minutes from the previous teleconference. Are there any objections to the approval of the minutes from the previous teleconference? Hearing no objections, so the minutes are approved and circulated by Craig. So we can move right on to our first item. Is, let's see, Ned, are you here?
Yes, I am.
Good. Okay, and did Jim Fetcher show up tonight, too?
yeah, I'm here.
Okay, I do. Ned, since you put the item on the agenda, do you want to make a quick introduction, and then we'll just let Jim take it from there on his topic tonight, and then we'll move into our Q&A when he's done, okay?
Sure. What I have here is Jim Fetcher is a
Before you start, is this road noise bothering anybody? Can people hear the road noise? If so, I'll mute my phone.
No, it's just a little muffled as you come in, but there's nothing.
Okay. Thank you.
There's no distortion, particularly, at least on my end.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Go ahead, man.
Sure. Jim Fetcher is a former Marine Corps officer. He's published widely on theoretical foundations of scientific knowledge, computer science, artificial intelligence, cognitive science, and the evolution and of evolution and mentality. He's McKnight Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota, Duluth, and he has also conducted extensive research into the assassination of JFK, events of 9/11, and the plane crash that killed Senator Paul Wellstone. He's the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and his latest books include The Evolution of Intelligence, 2005, The 9/11 Conspiracy, 2007, Rendered Unto Darwin, 2007, and The Place of Probability in Science, 2010. And I give you Jim Fetcher.
Ned, thanks very much. I really appreciate the invitation to come and share information about the Vancouver hearings, which I organized as a successor to the Madison hearings on the science and politics of 9/11, which I organized here in 2007. The Vancouver hearings involve more speakers divided into multiple areas, where I will give a brief summary of our major findings and then welcome any questions you may have about them. Probably what's most important about me in relation to 9/11 is that I'm a big tent guy. I believe that all theories and alternatives should be given consideration and evaluated on the basis of scientific reasoning, especially the principle known as inference to the best explanation, where the key concept is that the hypothesis which, if it were true, would confer the highest probability upon the available evidence is the hypothesis that has the highest likelihood, and where, when the sufficient evidence becomes available, when it's all more or less settled down, we are entitled to accept the hypothesis with the highest likelihood as true in the tentative and fallible fashion of science, which means as we gather more evidence and new alternatives, we may have to reassess our conclusions and perhaps accept some that we've rejected, reject some we've accepted, and leave others in suspense. I invited Steve Jones to be my co-chair when I founded Scholars in December 2005. Steve, of course, was noted for his work on nanothermite. I never quite bought the nanothermite theory. By June of 2006, during the American Scholars Conference held in Los Angeles, I asked Steve in the lobby whether he believed that nanothermite could perform all the feats he was attributing to it, including pulverizing concrete, decimating steel, and blowing the buildings apart, as we observe in the videos. And he assured me that it could, but I really remained unconvinced. And by the end of the year, in particular November 11th, 2006, I began, you know, broadening our search by inviting Judy Wood to be the featured guest on a show that I was then hosting to explain her views, which of course were completely different. This led to a rather strong reaction by Steve, Kevin Ryan, and others, who actually froze me out of the website that I'd made world famous. Every item that ever appeared on that website was one that I had placed there. Not that I placed it personally, but that I'd been responsible for having placed there. They did a phony poll using the membership list and pretending to be the membership administrator, which was false. They froze the website. I had to create a new one at 911scholars.org. And of course, this led to the formation of Scholars for Truth and Justice. Now, eventually I would do research with a chemical engineer who happens to work for NASA, but whose research on this topic was completely independent, by the name of T. Mark Hightower, who, as a part of a small research group, has surveyed all the scientific literature and discovered, in my opinion, definitively in relation to available technology in 2001, a nanothermite could not possibly have performed the feat Steve was attributing to it, that it's a principle, a law of material science, that in order to destroy a material, an explosive must have a detonation velocity equal to or greater than the speed of sound in that material. In the case of concrete, that speed of sound is 3,200 meters per second, steel 6,100 meters per second. But the highest available ascribed detonation velocity for nanothermite was 895 meters per second, which means you can't get there from there. So we published several articles about this even before the Toronto hearings in 2011.
Could you repeat those numbers you just gave?
Sure. Yeah, the speed of sound in concrete is 3,100 meters per second, 3,200 meters per second, and steel 6,100 meters per second. But the highest ever attributed to nanothermite is only 895 meters per second. We published several articles about this even before the Toronto hearings, was entitled, Has Nanothermite Been Oversold to the 9/11 Community? Another entitled, Is 9/11 Truth Based Upon a False Theory? After the Toronto hearings, Joshua Blakeney and I would both publish separate critiques of the Toronto hearings. Mine was entitled The Science and Politics of 9/11, the Toronto Hearings. Joshua's was The Pros and Cons of the Toronto Hearings. Mark Hightower would publish yet a third article entitled Nanothermite, If It Doesn't Fit, You Must Acquit, and where you can find the key articles by me and Joshua on the Vancouver Hearings website, which you can easily find by just entering the Vancouver Hearings, and the program for the event. We felt that there were substantial shortcomings of the Vancouver hearings that deserved compensation or supplementation, and therefore Joshua and I co-chaired the Vancouver hearings and sought to focus on one session of three speakers on what happened at the Pentagon, two sessions of three speakers each on how were the Twin Towers destroyed, another session about the fabrication of the four crash sites, another on who is responsible and why, and yet another about the role of the media in relation to 9/11, the media, the message, basically about the propagandistic, the failure to cover all of these discoveries adequately. The main results, just in a nutshell, were this. No Boeing 757 hit the Pentagon. The official trajectory is neither aerodynamically nor physically possible. It has a plane approaching on an acute northeast angle, barely skimming the ground, hitting multiple lampposts at over 500 miles an hour. A plane like a 757 at 500 miles an hour, because of what's known as ground effect, couldn't get closer than 60 or even 80 feet to the ground. Is a matter of aerodynamics, so it's not even aerodynamically possible. A plane hitting a stationary lamppost at 500 miles an hour has the same effect as a stationary plane being hit by a lamppost traveling 500 miles an hour. Would have ripped off the wing, the gas, the jet fuel stored inside would have burst into flame, it would have cartwheeled, tail broken off, gone into the ground. None of that happened. So the official account is a manifest absurdity. It's not only false and provably false, but isn't even consistent with the laws of physics and aerodynamics. It does appear to be the case that a plane was flown on a due easterly trajectory north of the Citgo station, corroborated by the CIT witnesses, at 300 feet in the air and approached the building, but was still 100 feet in the air above the building when they set off explosives and the plane flew over the building. I have gone through the 80 or more witnesses from the Pentagon for 3 2-hour sessions with a fellow named Mike Sparks, who's very, very smart and does work related to the defense industry. And we found that this testimony is quite ridiculous. It's further confirmed by witnesses like April Gallup and Karen Kowatowski and even Jamie McIntyre, who reported on the air how, when asked about a plane having hit the Pentagon, that from his close-up observation, it's clear no plane hit anywhere near the Pentagon. When you examine the actual hit point, which is on the ground floor and not the second floor that is very commonly featured as though it were the hit point, it's only about 10 feet high, 16 or 17 feet wide. You got chain link fence, you got two large spools of cable, a couple automobiles, unbroken windows, no massive pile of debris from a 100-ton airliner, no wings, no bodies, no seats, no luggage, no tail, not even the engines, which are virtually indestructible, recovered from the Pentagon. There's the short course. I've published multiple articles on this, but also discuss it in 9/11 Truth Will Out, the Vancouver Hearings 1, which has links to different articles. Number two, about the Twin Towers. The jet fuel, of course, doesn't burn at a high enough temperature, or neither hot enough nor long enough to cause the steel to weaken, much less melt. The very idea of steel having melted to cause this collapse is ridiculous on its face. The fires were distributed asymmetrically. If it had been hot enough and long enough, then it would have gradually sagged and tilted. It wouldn't have undergone a collapse. What we actually witness is inconsistent with the idea of a collapse. All the floors remain stationary. The building's blowing apart in every direction. I just observed that gravity works in one direction only. If you compare the destruction of the Twin Towers with that of Building 7, which actually did undergo a collapse, notice Building 7 is not blowing apart in every direction. Building 7, all the floors are collapsing at the same time. Building 7, when it's over, there's a stack of debris, multiple equal to about 12% of the height of the original, or about five, six, seven floors worth of debris. There should have been more than twice that for 110-story buildings. But in fact, they're being converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust. And when it's over, as Father Frank Morales from St. Mark's Episcopal Church, who was a first responder, reported on two of my radio shows, he was there. It was destroyed below ground level. You can see that fairly clearly in some of the photographs, especially those, say, looking at Building 6 with its huge gouged-out center. Over to the left, you can see Building 7 in the background, that massive stack of debris, and over to the right where Building 1, the North Tower, should have been nothing, nothing, nothing. So it's very clear that we've been sold quite a pack of goods here about the Twin Towers. Nanothermite, as I've already explained, cannot have done it. So we addressed whether it could have been a collapse, clearly not even physically impossible. In fact, Chuck Baldwin, who's a retired high school physics, chemistry, and math instructor, did a calculation that because the steel is tapered from the base to the top, if you took the top, say, 14 floors of the North Tower, which are alleged to have collapsed and brought about, you know, the successive collapse of the rest, you're talking about what actually represents 1.4% of the mass of the steel versus 98.6. In other words, the whole thing is a fantasy. If you assume, however, that the buildings are being blown apart using what appears to be most likely some combination of mini or micro nukes, quite possibly neutron weapons, And if you're taking them out in cubes, roughly, you know, 10 floors per second, then, of course, you've got 11 10-floor cubes, and that would approximate 11 seconds for the north tower. And in the south, because the top three floors tilt to the side and are taken out as one, 9 seconds. But I agree there's room for further discussion about exactly how this was done, but that appears to be the most promising theory, where we considered, you know, collapse, nanothermite, dews, some kind of nukes, Kalazov's theory of 150 megaton bombs at the base of each of the three major buildings is indefensible. It would have caused the same type of destruction of all three buildings when they're manifestly different. It would have caused the buildings to be destroyed from the bottom up, not from the top down in the case of the Twin Towers. And, of course, you know, it would have destroyed the bathtub, which is terribly important. In fact, I'm convinced the reason they had to do this very sophisticated job of destruction on the Twin Towers by converting it mostly into various fine particles is because they would remain suspended in the air. And, of course, they enveloped New York and eventually were blown out to sea and not come down, you know, in any mass sufficient to do serious damage to the bathtub, which, of course, functions as a dike to keep Hudson River water out, which would otherwise have flooded lower Manhattan, the subway tunnels, the PATH train tunnels. We're talking about the most valuable real estate in the world. So I'm quite convinced that the reason they had to contrive this very sophisticated mode of demolition for the Twin Towers is to save the bathtub. I would reiterate, by the way, that Gordon Ross and Craig Furlong in their article, Seismic Proof, 9/11 was an inside job, confirmed Willie Rodriguez's report of a massive explosion in the sub-basement of the North Tower, one also occurred in the sub-basement of the South Tower. It was when Willie came here to Madison and gave a talk, and he and I were having dinner afterwards, and he described to me watching the sub-basements of the North Tower fill up with water, that I realized that a principal purpose of those demolitions had to have been to drain the sprinkler systems, which were installed after a massive fire in the North Tower in 1975, which incidentally burned at a reported temperature around 2,000 degrees for 3 or 4 hours, which happens to be the capability that Kevin Ryan has reported was certified by UL, and they didn't have to replace the steel. That's when they installed the sprinkler system, which I'm convinced would have extinguished the very modest fires that remain after the spectacular fireballs were consumed in the first 15 or 20 seconds. The NIST itself, of course, inspected 236 samples of steel from the Twin Towers, found 233 had not been exposed to temperatures above 500 degrees Fahrenheit, which is the temperature of an ordinary office fire, and the other three not above 1,200 degrees. Well, those fires could have burned forever and not caused the steel to weaken or much less melt. In fact, the steel structure is a massive heat sink, and it's very difficult to heat up any part of such a structure because it's automatically, you know, distributed throughout the whole structure. So the whole thing, the whole idea behind the government's account is a manifest absurdity, as I'm sure we all agree in any case. Number three, about the fabrication of the crash sites, I've already explained about the Pentagon, but there's even more startling information available here. As Gerard Holmgren, the Australian blues musician, was the first to discern, even the government's own records, in particular Bureau of Transportation Statistics records showed that flights 11 and 77 weren't even scheduled to fly that day. I have FAA registration records which show that the planes associated with flights 93 and 175 were not deregistered or formally taken out of service until 28 September 2005, which raises the questions, how could planes that weren't even in the air have crashed on 9/11? And how can planes that crashed on 9/11 have still been in the air 4 years later? Pilots for 9/11 Truth has done some brilliant work. They tracked air ground communications and radar data for flights 93 and 175 and discovered they were both in the air, but that 93 was over Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, after it had allegedly crashed in Shanksville, and that flight 175 was over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, long after it had allegedly hit the South Tower, which means that none of the crashes that the government has claimed occurred actually took place. And each of those sites was subject to a different form of fakery or fabrication. I think Shanksville is the easiest to dispose of because, you know, the first reporters on the scene both reported the eerie aspect of the crash site was there was no indication that any plane had crashed there. There was a very modest amount of debris there. Colonel George Nelson, U.S. Air Force retired, observed that it looked to him as though someone had taken a bulldozer out there, dug a trench, filled it with trash, and blown it up. The famous photograph of Val McCatchy appears to show a cloud that is from a demolition that was imposed on this setting, not from a plane crash, and also geographically appears to be above the pond, not the alleged crash site. The claim is the plane disappeared into soft ground because it was a mining area. One version of this has it that the plane disappeared into an abandoned mine shaft. Well, we know what to do with miners trapped in mine shafts. We get out the heavy equipment, the bright lights, we dig 24/7 in the hope that by some miracle someone might have survived. That was not done here, even to recover the bodies. I mean, what a travesty had a plane actually crashed there. And so even after tidying up the area, they trimmed the bushes and the shrubs to make sure that no one could subject them to chemical analysis to determine whether or not, you know, they'd been caused by jet fuel. In fact, I have a report that the EPA came out to examine the ground to see if it was contaminated with jet fuel and discovered the answer was negative. The coroner, of course, reported ceasing to be medical examiner after 15 minutes because there were no body parts. He even reported later he hadn't found a speck of blood. So I don't think it's difficult to recognize that Shanksville was also a fabricated site. The interesting question is the North and the South Tower. Okay. Leslie Raphael, a Scottish student, has published an article about the improbability of the Nade brothers having to be in exactly the right position to effortlessly swing a camera up to capture the hit on the North Tower. In fact, since sound lags well behind an actual plane, if they were affected by the sound, they would have been looking in the wrong location, and yet this was an anticipatory capturing. He's observed over 100 improbable coincidences that had to be satisfied in order to be there, in order to capture this on film. A close frame-by-frame study by Marcus Ick shows that, in fact, it doesn't look anything like a Boeing 767. It looks like some weird something. Rosalie Grable has compared it to a flying pig. In numerous of my articles, I've shown the time sequencing that Marcus had done and compared it to what a 767 would have looked like. It bears no comparison at all. Ace Baker has observed that the wind effect should have taken place for the debris and so forth, the clouds that sort of covered the area while it appears the cutouts were being created, quite possibly using nanothermite. But whereas a plane passing through clouds is going to cause them to turn, you know, to be affected by turbulence, we don't see any of that in relation to the North Tower. The South Tower being the most fascinating of all, of course, where we have some, 52 or so videos. The most important being the Hezer Connie and the Evan Fairbanks. The Hezer Connie from the side, the Evan Fairbanks looking straight up the building. We have discovered, among other points, and pilots has confirmed that this plane, in the videos, traveling too fast to be a 767, is traveling in excess of 500 miles an hour, which would work for its cruising speed at 35,000 feet, but there the air is three times less dense than it is at 700 to 1,000, where the turbines can't suck the denser air through the engines and begin functioning as brakes. As John Lear, perhaps our nation's most distinguished pilot, has explained in an affidavit he gave for a lawsuit in New York. In addition, the plane, of course, effortlessly enters the South Tower. Actually, both the North and the South Tower intersecting multiple floors, the North Tower with seven different floors, the South Tower eight. Each of those floors consists of a steel truss connected to the core columns internally and then to the external steel support columns externally, filled with 4 to 8 inches of concrete, would have posed enormous horizontal resistance. What ought to have happened if we were witnessing a bona fide collision of a 767 with one of these towers? It would have crumpled, its wings broken off, tail, body seats and ground, body seats and luggage fall into the ground. Some parts of it might have entered through the windows, for example, and certainly the engines would have been massive enough. But those windows on those towers were designed deliberately to be narrow and thin for the sake of not allowing the building to heat up to place additional demands upon the air conditioning system. So it would have been a relatively small percentage that would have even entered the building. When you do a frame-by-frame advance, however, of both of those films, you discover that the plane traverses its entire length into the building in the same number of frames it traverses its entire length in air. Since distance equals rate times time, we have equal distances in equal times, which implies equal rates, which means there's not even any diminution in the velocity of the aircraft as it enters a massive 500,000-ton building. And, of course, a component that was alleged to have been from an engine that was found at Church in Murray turns out not even to be from a 767. It's underneath a steel scaffolding. It's sitting on a sidewalk. Something hitting a sidewalk at high speed of that mass would have damaged the sidewalk tremendously, but there are no signs of damage. It's clearly a plant, and Jack White, now deceased, who was a colleague of mine in JFK research, discovered Fox News footage in which you can see a white van at that intersection where men dressed in FBI vests are unloading something very heavy. So they put around a little more debris there, just as they did at the Pentagon. What I discovered at the Pentagon was a lot of photographs showing there wasn't any debris at all until much later, I mean, long after the civilian lime green fire trucks had shown up to extinguish the very modest fires. And included in that debris was a piece of fuselage from a 757, but it didn't display the characteristics one would expect of a violent collision. It looked as though it had been peeled off the plane. It's not crunched up, doesn't show any signs of singeing, exposure to fire, and captured in this piece of fuselage is a chunk of vine, not known to be indigenous to the Pentagon area. In fact, an attorney from Columbus, Ohio, by the name of James Hansen, tracked it back to a crash in Cali, Colombia that happened in 1995. Where a 757, you know, flew through jungle foliage as it crashed into the side of a mountain when the pilots lost track of where they were. So that the, you know, this is one nice illustration of Pentagon fakery. I suggested, therefore, that it had almost certainly been dropped from the C-130 that was circling the building, because it would have been too awkward to have officers and men carry this debris out onto the lawn. I explained this to the BBC when they interviewed me for the second time. They came a few years ago and interviewed me for 8 hours and then used 7.5 minutes of me, 4 hours of Alex Jones, 3.5 of Dylan Avery for their first conspiracy files study about 9/11. The rest of the 45 minutes of the rest of the program was all devoted to why anyone would hold such kooky ideas, not to an exploration of the evidence that I had explained to them in great detail during our 8 hours of conversation and filming, where Alex was pretty much supposed to be the, you know, the snot-nosed kid, Alex the messianic preacher, and I the kooky professor. I mean, that was the theme. That was done by their director.
I'm wondering, regarding the agenda, I just want to get a time check because I was going to be on after you. And is anyone keeping track?
Well, I've got...
Okay, let me take a moment here to apologize for being remiss in not getting the agenda confirmed before we proceeded. The agenda called for Jim to make his presentation and then for Q&A and then for 20 minutes, 15 to 20 minutes each, I believe, for Jonathan and Paul. So it now being 8:40... that means we really need to move to Q&A pretty quickly here.
I'll wrap it. I'll wrap it. No problem at all. So when the BBC did their second conspiracy theories program, whereas I had explained, you know, the clear, unblemished lawn, et cetera, and the role of the C-130, they instead switched the photographs from those I've been talking about to others taken later that showed debris on the lawn as though to imply I didn't know what I was talking about. I published about this in the article entitled The BBC's Instrument of 9/11 Misinformation. Finally, since the section devoted to the media didn't gel as well as the others and in fact led to some conflicts when one member of that group, Webster Tarpley, took strong exception to those who were addressing who was responsible and why, where there's a tremendous amount of evidence adduced by Kevin Barrett, Greg Felton, and Joshua Blakeney about the role of Israel, the Mossad, and 9/11, which, of course, complements the neocon agenda outlined in the Project for the New American Century, where it's pretty obvious the whole idea of creating the new Pearl Harbor, which, of course, David Ray Griffin picked up already in his very first book, was supposed to seize the unique historical opportunity provided by the demise of the Soviet Union in 1991, well, whereby moving aggressively into the Middle East, the United States could greatly advance the creation of a worldwide empire for the next 100 years. It of course, hasn't quite played out that way. We know all the lies that attended, followed 9/11. I would just point out that Afghanistan was invaded already on October 7th, just weeks after 9/11. No one would have had any idea, in fact, who was responsible or why. And the fact that all those crash sites were fabricated or fake means, of course, there were no planes for the hijackers to hijack. They weren't aboard any of the planes. Elias Davidson has demonstrated that clearly. The phone calls were fabricated, as David Ray Griffin and A.K. Dudeney have shown. Colonel Nelson, whom I mentioned before, has observed that of the millions of uniquely identifiable component parts, the government is yet, from those crash sites, the government has yet to produce even one. For the first time in its history, the NTSB did not investigate any of these crash sites. When an FBI official was asked why, he said it was because we didn't need to, we saw it on television. But as I'm explaining, what we saw on television is a very open question, where I would be glad to add more about a recent study done by Richard Hall entitled 3D Radar Study of Flight 175, which I think provides the missing pieces as to how they created the illusion of Flights 11 and 175 hitting the North and the South Tower. That's my quick take, which may have taken more time than intended, but there it is.
Well, Jim, I was really reluctant to interrupt you there because that was such a succinct summary of the evidence that had been presented that I would have. I really think it's important that we have it for reference since this conference is being recorded. So thank you very much for that. Before we move on to the questions, let me ask if Paul Zaremka is on the call. Are you on the call, Paul?
Yeah, I'm on the call.
Oh, okay. Yes. Because I thought if you weren't, maybe we would have more time to work with. Well, I'm thinking, because I know that a lot of people probably have questions for Jim and would like to discuss some of the points that he raised, and we should also deal with the question of prospects for future conferences, which was supposed to be part of what was discussed here. Is it possible that we could take Jonathan's and Paul's, how much time do you have, Jim?
I can stay here as long as you like.
Well, I'm thinking that if we go ahead and just do the 15 minutes each for these other two items and then open it up for the Q&A and let that be extended past our normal time, I think that's probably the only fair way to handle this, to give everybody a real chance to get out of the discussion, because I know a lot of people would like to further discuss a lot of what you've talked about. Does that seem like a reasonable approach to people?
Robin on the stack.
Robin?
Yes, it does.
I actually think that what Jim has presented, of which I have significant questions, probably deserves another teleconference, if not devoted completely to him, most of it. And I would suggest that what we do is deal with the next two and then ask Jim if he can join us on a future teleconference. None of this stuff is going away ever. Okay, and so
but he could join us also tonight afterwards, so
something
desirable about that is I sent multiple links which Ned distributed, but now you might have a greater motivation for reviewing them, because the points I've been making are elaborated in considerable detail in those multiple articles that were linked, and I just added a new one related to the faking of the four crash sites from a presentation I gave in Seattle on my way to Vancouver that is, easily accessible, too. So I'm glad to do both. You know, I'll be glad to hang around, because we have guests from out of town actually coming back is in a personal way preferable to me, but I certainly have the time to stay here and field questions. So I'm glad to do it either way or both.
Well, great, Joe. If you could commit to being here on the following teleconference, which would be the last Wednesday in January, what we could do then is invite people who didn't make this call to go back and listen to this call, which is recorded, and they can listen to your presentation and bring their questions to the next one if we don't have enough time for them after we handle Jonathan and Paul's items today.
I think that's a great plan. I subscribe to that.
Super. Okay, thank you for your flexibility.
You're welcome to stay around, too, because we'd like
yeah.
to
hear
your questions. Yeah, I certainly would like to continue the questions tonight if we can, but I know that we owe Paul and John a chance to get their issues dealt with, too. So let's see if we can do that and then revert back to the Q&A, start the Q&A, and then we can complete the Q&A next week, or next month, I'm sorry.
Perfect.
If that's agreeable to everybody. Okay, who was first? John, Craig, you have the menu for the Jonathan?
Yeah.
I believe you were, yeah, because you submitted yours first. Okay,
okay,
so go ahead and present your proposal and motivate it, and then we'll open it up to discussion for 15 minutes, okay?
Yes, I'll just take the whole thing in 15 minutes. I'll try it, but let me know when 10 minutes is up, if you can. Okay, my idea here is to basically utilize the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination and show the linkage to September 11th. Because as far as I'm concerned, you couldn't have had such a sophisticated false flag operation and cover-up unless you did have such controls in place as when Kennedy was murdered, and ever since then, you can see from the foreign policy and from the development of intelligence, psyops, and other elements connected to the military-industrial complex, they've been, you know, riding high, and 9/11 was an acceleration to their endeavors for a global plan, and very much involved with military and development and usage. So being that this November 22nd, 2013 marks the 50th anniversary, people are going to be remembering that. And I was wondering if we can have more, you know, conversations about what can be done in order to show the linkage regarding it. I did a film called Dark Legacy, JFK and 9/11, and showing, connecting the dots. But more than just JFK and 9/11, I was also showing the relationship to the Federal Reserve and the notes that Kennedy was backing and the development of the Federal Reserve in 1913, as well as the moon landing evidence of a hoax. But the key of connecting with JFK, I believe, is even more significant than any other issue in regards to 9/11 because it's almost two-thirds of the nation is aware of it being a conspiracy, but we never dealt with the consequences of it. And now we hear the MKUltra and other things that we thought was stopped in the 70s are continuing, and things have gotten much further down the road of the 1984 state. So I also would like to ask this group for reviewing my film. I did a short version of it, a 58-minute version, showing these interconnecting lockage, and I'm hoping that I'm also connecting a national initiative for direct democracy with that, because I can't think of anything that I would rather have the 99% interest people do than nonviolently vote to amend the Constitution and demand that they could enact investigations and in fact enact laws that could maybe return us to a just society for the people. And we're certainly entitled to do it. And I think we get lost in, you know, getting into the details because the greater crime of 9/11 isn't just the technology that was used to bring the buildings down. It's just the actions themselves and the cover-up, which there's awful amount of evidence for as well. And so if we could, you know, more or less agree on what we agree and then expand to other groups like people aware of JFK and showing them why it's linked and doing stuff. So I just want to open this up for feedback regarding the JFK 9/11 connection, anything I said.
Robin on the stack.
Go ahead, Robin.
Okay, there's Robin. Who else said Robin wanted to speak?
Oh, I want to address it. Yeah.
Okay, Robin, go ahead.
Okay, this is for you, Jim, and actually everybody here, because I've still maintained my presence in the public between one and five times a week for the last 5 or 6 years, and I'm going to give you some feedback. The problem that we have in the 9/11 Truth community and the bright people that are doing all of the investigations is that we are operating with 9/11 and call them other nefarious government activities, 404. Most of the people who are able to comprehend and are strong enough to shoulder, okay, nefarious activities by corporations and the government are not really our problem. Our problem is people who are operating in a much less uninformed or much more uninformed space and who are not as strong as we are. I call them reality 101. So no matter what anybody does, we need to create approaches to deal with the people in the street who just aren't dealing with what we're dealing with.
Yeah, I agree.
Robin, let me interrupt you for a second here, because we are supposed to be on Jonathan's issue right now. Jonathan, I don't think you really clarified exactly what it is that you were asking this group to do, and you should really do that before we...
I would like to respond to Robin, because in a way he is responding to what I was communicating.
Everybody needs to be clear on what it is that you're asking us to do, okay? What exactly is it that you want us to do?
Okay, I was opening up for a discussion of ideas of how to best unite this issue. I produced a film...
Okay.
And in the film, it kind of like is geared towards community television stations, which is exactly what Robin was talking about. You want to reach people that you wouldn't even see on the street to give them a DVD. You're almost they're just going to be watching a TV in their community station, and they get this information. So I think it's a valuable resource. And I'm Chris Pratt of QCMagazine.org. He has like millions of viewers now because he has on community TV in San Francisco and other, populated areas. And I think the more that we work together to unite this sleeping mass and discuss how we could, that's why I want to utilize the 50th anniversary, because by November, everyone's going to be thinking about Kennedy. You're not going to be able to get away from it. And we, if we do enough preparation work and enough insight work, we could then convert those people that became interested in the 50th anniversary of JFK, and they'll be able to see how this is connected to 9/11.
I think it's a very good idea. You are probably unaware, but I organize a research group of the most highly qualified individuals to ever study the assassination back in 1992. I have published 3 collections of studies by experts on different aspects of the assassination, including Assassination Science 1998, Murder in Dealey Plaza 2000, The Great Zapruder Film Hoax in 2003. We discovered almost immediately that the autopsy x-rays had been altered to conceal a massive blowout to the back of the head, that another man's brain had been substituted for that of JFK, because once they patched up that hole in the back of the head, there was nowhere for all those brains to go, and that they revised massively the whole movies, including the Zapruder film, because the driver, William Greer, had actually pulled the limousine to the left and to a halt to make sure that JFK would be killed. We have multiple evidence for this. We know where it was done, how it was done, when the substitution took place, which was already over the weekend. The original film was taken in the National Photographic Interpretation Center on Saturday. It was an 8mm already split film developed in Dallas.
I know that we could do a whole teleconference just on the evidence of the Kennedy decision. I know that you've got a lot of research on it. But right here, I think Jonathan is asking How can we make the link in the 9/11 truth movement?
Just to add one further note, the first article I published, first serious article about all this stuff, is entitled Thinking About Conspiracy Theories, 9/11 and JFK, where I use JFK as an intro to talking about 9/11, because as he is correctly discerning, the techniques that were used in that case were just multitudinous, fabricating photographs, faking evidence, the backyard photographs, altering films, all this kind of stuff, which is why when I came into 9/11 research, I really had a pretty good idea of the sorts of things to look for. By the way, I just want to mention there's a new film out there called Operation Terror that creates very nice narrative about how 9/11 could have been done. And while I believe
it's
a really valuable contribution.
We just had a teleconference on that question last
link. But, Jim, you're in my film, Dark Legacy, JFK and 9/11, in part one of the original version from the Wellstone film, They Killed Them. So I would like you to look at this film and consider reviewing it in any way. If you go to flybynews.com, you'll see the film there. It's online and easy to watch.
Well, I'd be glad for us to have email communication and all that. My address is real easy to find. If you go to Veterans Today, Jim Fetzer, it's right there. jfetzer@d.umn.edu. I'd be very pleased for us to discuss this further.
Wonderful.
This is Robin, back on the original point that I was making, which is that 404s, talking to 404s are useless until we break down what we know and what we see to dealing with the average public, which is 101s, okay? We're not going to make any progress. We are just spinning our wheels, talking amongst ourselves.
Robin, what's your suggestion regarding the JFK 9/11 issue?
Jonathan, the overwhelming evidence is that, you know, some 50 years later, 83% of the people in this country understand that the government is lying and covering itself up about the events on JFK assassination. This has occurred because there has been a consistent, constant flow of information that has basically broken down eventually to be able to reach the people who are not who we are regarding 9/11. It's got to do with breaking down the information that we have so it can be handled, understood, and handled both intellectually and, more importantly, emotionally, okay, about what's going on.
Well, I'm hoping
that's my point. So just break it down, make it simple.
I think you need
step
to make
by
a
step.
Proposal for an actual plan to do that, because I'm all in favor of that, and that's why I did the film that I did.
I am at the moment working with a filmmaker trying to break down all of the highfalutin stuff into simple bite-sized pieces, okay, that just link some stuff up in extraordinarily specific relationships. It's got to do with their daily lives. That's the point. What do we have to do with the daily lives of people? That's all.
Robin is mistakenly assuming that we only have one track here. We can do this in multiple tracks, and I personally believe that the American people would find the truth utterly fascinating. I've yet to hear any objection from any audience where I have discussed the use of video fakery or the faking of the planes and the crash sites on any of the multitudinous radio interviews and public presentations I've made. So I believe Robin is underestimating the intelligence and open-mindedness of the American people to a considerable degree.
All right.
Okay, but before we get let's not get into that for a moment. What we have here is a film that Jonathan is recommending that people take a look at as a way of possibly linking to ideas. And Jonathan, if you would send the link to your film to Craig, we can put that in the minutes. And then Jim mentioned the article on the relationship between 9/11 and the Kennedy assassination. And Jim, if you would send that link to Craig, we can put that in the minutes too and ask people to take a look at that. And then maybe we can continue the discussion. I think we would all agree that this is a vital discussion and we should continue it.
Yeah,
thank you very
good.
Much. Thank you very much.
So let's leave it there for now with those links, and ask people to we'll just put it back on the agenda for next week to continue the discussion. Okay.
Okay.
Next
month.
All right. Thank you. And let's see, Paul, your issue, please. Go ahead.
Yeah. Let me just. I'm much slower with these things than Jim Fester is. I mean, he's got the whole thing laid out, and I respect that, and I want to make some comments about it. But one of the reasons why I put the Toronto hearings on this teleconference is precisely because Jim was going to be talking about the Vancouver conference, and everybody knows that there was kind of an implicit dialogue between those two conferences. And just at the time, like a week or two before Jim was announced for this conference, the book for the Toronto conference arrived in my mailbox, so it was an appropriate opportunity to bring up the Toronto hearings in the way it's presented to the public, which is now published by a volume edited by James Gourley, who was one of the people who organized it. And I'm going to make some comments, and I'm going to try and, I mean, I'm not trying to be too judgmental, but I'm going to try and be factual. I think before I start that, I mean, people should remember, if they don't already know, that I was first asked to participate in the Toronto hearings, and then I was removed from it, and then I was brought back. It was back and forth. And the reason for that was because I asked some questions about what the choice criterion for who would be at the Toronto hearings, who would be making decisions. And I mean, I wasn't saying how it should be done. I was just asking how it was being done, and that caused them a lot of trouble. But anyway, whatever, okay? But it kind of shows up again when you read the book, because one of the things that and Jim, you must know this intimately, everybody who's ever organized a conference, and I've organized conferences, everybody who's ever organized a conference knows that a lot of people are involved. I mean, people just, you know, students or whatever, or staff or what, a lot of people are involved in the conference. And you read the Toronto hearings, if you read the introduction, there is no description whatsoever of how this conference occurred. They don't even tell you who the steering committee was for the conference. It's presented by James Gourley, and that's the end of it. I mean, Kevin Ryan is not mentioned as an organizer. There's three other organizers, including Graham McQueen, Adnan Zaberi, and the woman, Laurie Manuel. I mean, none of their names are mentioned as being organizers. And none of the people who helped, I mean, I was there. I saw how much work it took to make the conference, and none of those people are mentioned. It annoyed me that here's a conference which is just seemingly done in its entirety by one person. Now, obviously, that can't possibly be the case. But anyway, also, the introduction to the book doesn't describe, you know, what took place when, and which contributions are not included. It has presentations that are included, but it doesn't mention, for example, that Richard Gage gave a whole presentation that he usually does, but it doesn't tell you that it gives three pages that he does jointly with somebody else, but doesn't give the presentation that he actually gave. And there's other people like Jay Kolar, who made a presentation, who are not there, not mentioned. So anyway, I'm just alerting you to, when you look at the book, it's not exactly what happened at the conference itself. But on the other hand, now this is the positive side. At least in some respects to me, they had four judges brought from the outside, including a distinguished, very distinguished judge from Italy, who, I mean, it was really a very nice legal statement about what you have to do to convict somebody of crimes in an international court. And I mean, it was really a presentation of somebody who really has been down the road of prosecuting a situation like this. But it was also a couple of other judges who, I mean, judges of now of the conference who I thought were interesting. One of them was a man named Jenkins, who's a professor at McMaster, who's a professor of psychology, and probably among the four judges was the one who was the, I'm not totally convinced. I'm not saying the others said that they were totally convinced, but there was, he explicitly states that he has reservations about proofs of 9/11 being an inside job. Now, I'm not putting him down at all for doing that. In fact, I appreciate the fact that they had somebody there who needed to be further convinced, if you want to put it that way. I don't know if I want to, I was going to take time in sort of reading one paragraph of what his concerns are, but maybe I'll just summarize it. One of his concerns is that there are so many people who had to do something in connection with 9/11 in various and multitudinous ways which supported the operation of an inside job, and yet we don't have many of those people coming, we basically don't have almost anybody coming forward saying that they participated in it. He goes through a whole list of not names of people, of course, but names of aspects of 9/11, which you would have expected somebody to come forward somewhere. And I thought that was rather interesting. The other interesting aspect of it is, six of the 13 chapters that are in the book have to do with the World Trade Center, the Kevin Ryan type presentations that I think all of us perhaps all of us have been exposed to. But there are seven other chapters which are not having to do with the World Trade Center, and a couple of them actually are not even that convinced that 9/11 is an inside job. For example, there was a professor from Florida. I didn't know him before this conference. De Havilland Smith, I think is his name. I may have it slightly wrong, who was arguing for state crimes against democracy. And he lists a whole bunch of different crimes. And what's interesting is that when he comes to the JFK assassination and he comes to 9/11, he considers the evidence of it being both of these being inside jobs or being government instituted inside jobs as only medium, not high evidence. Both of the Kennedy case and the 9/11 case, which I found kind of interesting, given that that was a 9/11 conference. He has other cases which he considers to be high probability and low high levels of evidence and low levels of evidence, but these two are medium levels of evidence. I think that's all I want to say at this point. What I'm really trying to do is encourage people to get a copy of the book, and then we could deal with it at another teleconference. I suppose most people don't have the book yet, so I'm basically trying to give people a little bit of a taste of it so that we can bring it into another conference. But the last thing I want to say is that I think there's a big difference between the Toronto conference and the Vancouver conference, and it would be very nice to discuss the formation of those two conferences in one of our teleconferences. For example, if I'm listening, as I listen to Jim, I get the impression, the way you presented it, Jim, you presented it as if all the pieces of the puzzle of the Vancouver conference sort of fell into place, except perhaps partly. While in the Toronto hearings, it really wasn't, I don't think they fell, they didn't, the pieces didn't fall together quite so well. I don't know if I'm... if I don't understand the Vancouver conference so well, but that's kind of the impression I got from listening to you.
That's pretty fair, Paul. And there were, several of us involved in organizing. Kevin Barrett played an important role, Joshua Blakeney and I, in organizing, and we went through a lot of different potential speakers and all that. I even invited let's see, Niels Herit to speak. I invited Judy Wood to speak. I invited John Hutchison to speak. I invited CIT to speak. I invited Rob Bassamo to speak. For various reasons, you know, a number of those that I wanted to add to the mix. So we'd have, you know, the strongest proponents of different views decline to come. In fact, actually, there was an effort by one of those you have mentioned to undermine the Vancouver hearings, I'm very sorry to say. Richard Gage actually discouraged two of my key players on the scene from participating with us in bringing it about, which I find very difficult to appreciate. But I'd be glad to address all those questions you raise. I think your reaction is very appropriate. And the concealment of the actual organizers to me is appalling. I mean, how is that reasonable, responsible, honest, transparent, or open? I think your points are excellent.
Okay. If I may, this is Ken facilitating. It seems to me that the question of the relationship between these two conferences and their strong and weak points relative to each other would be very useful in a second discussion that would have been a second part of Jim's presentation today, namely prospects for future conferences. So I think we ought to consider putting that at the top of at the section next time when Jim speaks. I'll let Jim address the question of what he feels to be the prospects for future conferences, and then we can start talking about the pros and cons of the past conferences and how they relate to these future conferences. I think that's a very important subject for this.
I agree with all that. The guy who said the evidence, the conspiracy for JFK and 9/11 was only medium, has his head where the sun doesn't shine. There's overwhelming evidence, including even violations of laws of physics, engineering, and aerodynamics involved in both cases. It's ridiculous that he should make that claim. I would be glad to debate this fellow and demonstrate he could not be more mistaken.
Well, in fairness, Jim, I think what the fellow said wasn't saying that the case against the government official theory was medium. He was saying the case for the government having perpetrated it was medium.
When you get into the cover-up, perpetrating acts like these is not in and of itself the hard part. Murdering JFK wasn't the hard part. It was covering it up. That's what reveals who was really responsible and why. There are more than 15 indications of Secret Service complicity in setting JFK up for the hit. The CIA, military, mafia, local law enforcement were involved in taking him out. The FBI was used to cover it up. J. Edgar and Lyndon Johnson were principals with financing from Texas oilmen. There's quite a lot of evidence here, I mean, believe me, that implicates the government. I won't go further, but I will send some links.
More about the 9/11. But, Paul, thank you for giving us a preliminary summary. Unfortunately, apparently, the book is still only available for sale in hard copy. Do you know if there are any plans to put it online?
No, it's available on Amazon.com, isn't it? It's soft cover.
Do you know that if it's ever going to be published digitally, in other words, put online for people to read if you wish?
I do not. I haven't been told that, no. I don't know.
All right. Does anybody have a question or comment on Paul's presentation on the review of the Toronto Harris, the book? Would you like to speak to that?
Ned on the side.
Ned, go ahead.
Robin on the stack.
Okay, Ned, then Robin. Ned, then Robin. Go ahead, Ned.
Robin on the stack.
I got you, Robin. You're after Ned.
This would be a comment, and it's in the form of a question. They're talking about different conferences and whatever it might be, and it's thematic to what I'm saying, which is the important move is to reach people 101, not 404. Will there ever be an ultimate final conference, per se, on 9/11? Personally, I hope not.
Can I respond to that, Paul?
No, I don't have any. The only comment I'd make is there is another conference planned in Nancy, France, next September 9th to 11th that's had a call out, and all papers are supposed to be proposed by yesterday, precisely.
Oh, my gosh. I didn't even hear about that.
Yeah, it's done by a guy who is not well known in the 9/11 movement. It's supposedly the first European conference, or the first mainland European conference, as opposed to the British. I don't know, but anyway, there is a call out there for sure.
Wow, do you have a link for that?
Yes, I do. I could pass it on. It's it'll be in Lorraine, the University of Lorraine in Nancy, France. And Nancy is Nancy in English. Okay.
Yeah. Craig, can we note that in the minutes, please? For people
sure.
To reference. Okay, great. All right. So any other see Robin, you went. Ned, and you've already gone, right?
No, I haven't gotten in there yet.
Okay, you were supposed to be first. Go ahead, Ned. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, all right. I had two questions. I was wondering about particular issues that would or may have been addressed by either Toronto and or Vancouver. And that had to do, one, with a particular group of individuals that seemed to have common traits that were affiliated with Larry Silverstein. And the other was a follow-up on people that were connected with put options. Was there any discussion or exploration of those issues?
Well, put options is exactly the topic I did in the Toronto hearings. I mean, yes, so the answer is yes at Toronto. Are you asking more than that, or what are you asking exactly?
No, specifically, I was wondering every once in a while I hear discussion about put options, but very seldom do you hear any names associated with people that were involved with placing those options.
Oh, no, I don't provide any names of who did it. No, I don't know. I don't know.
Well, Lee Hamilton and Thomas Keene, traced them back to their source, which was the CIA, and they therefore concluded that they couldn't have had anything to do with 9/11, which is simply absurd. It was what, Grounauer? I think this is fairly well known. I'm sure it was mentioned during the Vancouver hearings, though probably more could have been done with it.
Okay. Any other questions on false presentation?
Yeah, when you asked about Silverstein, I don't think Silverstein came up in Toronto. I don't think so, anyway.
Well, I'm pretty sure we had some discussion, I mean, I'd have to go back and review the whole thing. By the way, most of the actual presentations, the audio files, are available at the Vancouver Hearings webpage, which is at www.911vancouverhearings.com. I notice I had an extra letter in the link I gave on the links that Ned distributed. But you can now find, apart from the very first session and the first paper of the second session, all of the other sessions, the audio files are available there, right there on the webpage.
Will there be a book published? Will it come out as a book also, as a report or anything like that?
Well, I'm working on that. We have, a lot of stuff. You'll find a lot of links to the presentations, too, for the most part, the PowerPoint and all that, a few of which you'll actually see the video, but we had a real problem with a live stream, which was supposed to be what went out while they were recording a much higher quality, in-house version, but the in-house version never was recorded, so we got stuck with that. When we go further, I'll certainly share the information.
Well, Jonathan, we got to make sure we get that link in the minutes, okay? With the proper spelling this time, so everybody can check that out.
You mean Craig, not Jonathan?
I'm sorry, Craig. Yes, I'm sorry, Craig.
Emailing the correct link right now.
Thank you so much, Jim. Appreciate that. Okay, I think that concludes our formal agenda for today, and so it's now being, what time is it now?
8:21.
Let's see. Well, we normally have at least 10 minutes left in our normal amount of time, and we're going to try to extend it today, so we'll go right back to where we were in opening the floor for discussion with Jim on what he has presented already, remembering that we'll try to reserve questions about prospects for future hearings to the next teleconference when Jim will join us, okay? So try to focus more on what he's already presented. Paul, I've got you
Paul
first.
And the
Jonathan?
And Paul?
Paul and Jonathan?
Robin on the staff.
Paul, Jonathan, then Robin. Paul, Jonathan, then Robin, yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Can I go ahead?
Sure.
Yeah,
okay. Jim, I just want to ask you a couple of details. I know Barbara Honecker was in the Vancouver.
Barbara's the only person who spoke at both.
Okay. What is I'm asking your opinion, your take on her clock evidence. The reason why I ask is because I never believed the fact that she shows two clocks which have hands which are very close to 9:30, 9:31 as opposed to 9:37 as being substantive evidence that something else happened at 9:30, 9:31. When in fact we don't know the chain of custody of those clocks, and furthermore, the clocks could have fallen off the wall and been jumped down toward 9:30 from 9:37, and apparently there was also another Pentagon clock which did not fall off the wall, which did stay at 9:36, 9:37. In other words, I'm not convinced by the clock evidence, and I'm just wondering what your take on that clock evidence is.
Well, I think
it's of any importance.
I'm probably rather disposed to agree with you on this, that it's not completely settled. I haven't found it, persuasive one way or the other. I mean, she makes an argument. Barbara's pretty good at marshaling arguments. Some of her arguments, I think, are better than others. I think it's a very legitimate question, and I would want to, review the bidding further before I said anything stronger. I think your question's a perfectly appropriate one.
And, yeah, the second part of my question was about AA-77, the one that allegedly went into the Pentagon. You said that the plane didn't even take off, and I mean, I know that whole discussion about the plane didn't take off, but I want to ask, is the basis of your claim that the plane was not scheduled the tail number of that plane, or what is the basis? Are you saying it's the
tail
number?
Well, sure, it's the Bureau of Transportation Statistics' own database. The records show
But you're tracing it from the tail. Are you tracing it from the tail number?
It would be the tail number that identifies a plane, and that's also true for the FAA registration data.
Okay. But let me suggested you look at page 53 of the second edition of my book, or go to the first edition of the book, because the tail number of AA-77, the American Airlines changed the tail number. They used a different tail number than the actual photograph of the tail number. And I showed three pictures of that plane with the tail number you are looking at, which actually used a different tail number on three occasions and landings in various places. And that tail number did land in Dallas.
Wait a minute. Did land in Dallas?
Dallas.
You mean this would be the plane that flew over the Pentagon and then landed at Dallas?
Right. In other words, the transportation database, when you trace it through the officially stated tail number, isn't the proper tail number to use, only because American Airlines used a different tail number for some of its planes, and maybe even all of them, I don't know, but plane.
It's
a very technical thing. Maybe we should talk about this.
I think it's a great question, and I actually show the pages of the Bureau of Transportation Statistics data in my presentations. I mean, it's both in, I think, Planes, No Planes, and Video Fakery, Reason and Rationale in Public Debate, the case of Rob Assamo, but also in both my presentation in Vancouver and my Seattle presentation, which was the most recent link I sent to Ned for distribution for this evening. So you can find right there the basis.
I think I solved the problem. I solved the problem. Okay.
Worth discussion. Yeah, good.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks, Paul. Jonathan, you're next. Robin and me.
Yeah. Jim, I just want to point out, I believe you said that Thermite wasn't capable of you know, has been shown not to have ever been shown to have such explosive forces to it. And you said something about with Dr. Judy Wood. Have you ever seen that technology confirmed? And why wouldn't a militarized nanothermite explosive development, theoretical one, because you don't have proof of it, but why wouldn't that be more feasible than an energy weapon that has no proof, with the dust sound and the molten metal?
Yeah. Well, I've gone round and round. I've gone round and round with Judy and her gang, who I regard as members of a cult, frankly, because they won't brook any criticism. I pointed out that in her book, for which I gave a 5-star review on Amazon because of the brilliance of her compilation of the evidence that needs to be explained, appeared to have a crucial weakness regard to nukes. It appears to have been an add-on in her chapters. At the end of her chapter, she summarizes what went on in the rest of the earlier parts of the chapter. In this case, that chapter doesn't include the summary about nukes. It's clearly inadequate. Her definition of a directed energy weapon is very broad and encompassing. It simply says that it's a device that can provide much more energy than conventional explosives and can be directed, which is going to suit, it's going to fit the micro nukes and all that, which can be shaped and directed. So I really don't think Judy has ever been able to prove her case. I think it suffers from too many ambiguities and vagaries. I do think she did a brilliant job of compiling, most of the evidence that needs to be explained. But, and this is very interesting because it ties together the nanothermite people with the dew people. She doesn't take into account the dust evidence found in the samples collected by the U.S. Geological Survey of barium and strontium and cesium and up to deuterium. I mean, there are a host of indications that this had to have been a nuclear event, if not in whole, at least in large part, which we inventory. If you go to 9/11 Truth Will Out, the Vancouver hearings too, you'll find a very nice summary overview. And since then, we published a subsequent article entitled Mini Neutron Bombs, a Major Piece of the 9/11 Puzzle. The dust business was completely obfuscated because of Jones and Ryan and Herod and all that claiming they'd studied the dust. It gave you the impression they'd really studied the dust. They studied a small number of samples, and they only looked for these little iron spheres and so forth. They did not actually analyze the elements that are present in the dust that are so extremely revealing. So I regard that as one of the colossal blunders of the last 6 years, because of their talking about the dust and their claims. I regard the whole community as being run up a blind alley about nanothermite, even after we demonstrated conclusively, in my opinion, that nanothermite is not explosive. We did hear reports back, but that if it were combined with an explosive, it could become explosive, which I point out is also true of toothpaste. And Kevin Ryan went on to publish a piece on the explosiveness of nanothermite that didn't address any of our issues.
Well, but you agree that the details of what happened exactly, since we won't be 100% sure, no matter what hypothesis or theory we take, isn't quite as significant as the cover-up, which shows the real fingerprint on who was involved what was involved. So that's been a sad part of your presentation to me. I was thinking of how often, we disagree on little points, but the bigger issue we really agree on is just the focus that we lose.
I disagree with you completely. I'm a truth, whole truth, nothing but the truth kind of guy. I'm not going to compromise on science for the sake of politics. In my opinion, that's been done too much in the 9/11 truth community. I think that's the serious flaw.
When you understand that energy weapons were more likely than a militarized nanothermite, that wasn't the truth and the whole truth. That was your opinion.
Oh, come on, man. We've gone through this nanothermite.
Jonathan. Yeah. But you asked him his opinion, okay? I mean, to be fair about this, let's give somebody else a chance to give the other discussion here.
Yeah.
Robin, it's your turn.
Yes, this is kind of a slight rebuttal to what Jim had said to me about my impression, interpretation, feeling, opinion about the average citizen and where they are versus where whom I call 9/11 404s are. And also, Jonathan, this is to you because it's the same discussion. I have been in the streets with regular people between 1 and 5 times a week all around the Puget Sound, other parts of the country, okay, in the streets with real, regular people. I have not been at conferences. I have not been operating in academic environments. I have been dealing with real people. And this is where my opinion has been formed. Okay, Jonathan, here is the word, that the one word that I would give to you that I think explains the 83-85% of the country who have finally, 50 years later, accepted that the government, or believe that the government, was involved one way or another in JFK's assassination. The word is osmosis. And this is what I'm going to say to you, Jim. I have no trouble with the wide variety. I'm thrilled by the wide variety of investigation, contrary opinions. I've authored Friendly Fences, which is a far better way to deal with the differing opinions that nobody has accepted right now. But the bottom line of the story is that when we're talking at this level that we're talking 404. Jonathan has asked, how do I reach the people? I'm saying osmosis. I'm saying that we have to break down our information into simpler, easier to accept bits of information. A fellow I'm working with on the next DVD put out a DVD of his own, okay, that's tremendous, which is 9/11 in Context, Ken Jenkins. And when I looked at the DVD, I emailed him right away, and I said, look, Ken, I said, absolutely everything that you put in here is absolutely correct. I'm in it. I'm on it. I'm with it. Put me by your shoulder. I got your back. I'm ready. Show me the battlefront. I'm there. I'm okay. But when what you put in this DVD hits the average person is going to say, this system is so fucked, I'm going to quit. There's no way I can change it. There's no way that I can be involved. And this is the challenge of the 9/11 truth community. I'm so tired of people talking about nano this, psycho that, blah, 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 okay? The bottom line of the story is it was an inside job, okay? And the inside job was directed at the American people. They don't get it. We have to take time and figure out a way to educate them to understand that this is their country or our country. This is our world. And the 9/11 truth community is soaring so high and having so many discussions at so many nanotechnical points that they've lost track of the focus. Jonathan. Well,
I think you made your point, Robin. Did you want to respond to that, Jeff?
Oh, I'd only say, Robin's talking about marketing. I'm talking about truth. He's talking about politics. I'm talking about science. I think what he's talking about is fine. I think we need to promote easily accessible versions of what we have discovered for the general public, and also to make them aware that there's much more that we know that is more technical and more scientific. I don't see an incompatibility relationship. I would say, Robin, go for it. Meanwhile, those of us who are trying to figure out, you know, all of the details will continue to persevere, and you can work on figuring out how to make our findings most accessible to the public. So I don't think there's an inherent conflict.
Hey, Fetzer, okay, no offense to you, but what you just said to me is very offensive. I'm digging every day, every week on the radar and aviation and all kinds of other data. So don't tell me that I'm not operating at your level. I am. I also happen to be operating at the level of the street. And I'm
stop tuning your own horn and give other people a chance to talk. I'm on the list too. I'd like to ask Jim a question too. Jim, you're on record, I think, is basically asserting that Israel had a role in the perpetration of 9/11. Is that a fair summary? What would you say is the most compelling piece of evidence that demonstrates not just Israeli foreknowledge, but Israeli perpetration? What one piece of evidence would you point people to demonstrate that thesis?
Well, you know, we even have radio reports of arresting this group of Israelis with explosives heading for the George Washington Bridge. I mean, this is beyond the five dancing Israelis. It's beyond all the transference of the real estate from, you know, Israel did 9/11. All the proof in the world is just chock full, just loaded with information about Israel. What I think is the check catch there is it tends to minimize the role of the American neocons in the Department of Defense, because there's no way that stand down, all those training ops that Webster has inventoried and his list keeps growing and growing, would have kept our planes out of the air, where they didn't want to have them fly up to intercept the hijacked planes and find there was nothing there. Go back to war games, and you remember how Crystal Palace sent a couple of planes up to check out the Russian bombers flying across Alaska and discovered there was nothing there, which is one way they knew the Whopper had gone offline, you know, and believing that an imaginary drill was a real one. I mean, there's a massive evidence about Israeli complicity, some of which, by the way, a very nice piece, is entitled 9/11 in Zion, What Was Israel's Role, by Nick Kohlerstrom, which I assisted in and published on my website. So I recommend that, 9/11 in Zion, What Was Israel's Role, a very nice piece.
Thank you for that. And Robin, are you still on the line?
Yes.
Good, because I just wanted to say that I think, you know, the idea of osmosis is important, but the osmosis has to be from something to something. And in the case of the Kennedy assassination, there were many years of research prior to the osmosis taking place. And that's going to, unfortunately, the cart comes before the horse, in my opinion. I just wanted to throw that out. So who else would like to be
Yeah, but that? Wait a minute, Ken. I have never stated that I didn't think that we shouldn't keep doing what we're doing. I'm reacting to Jonathan Mark's request about how can he take what he has developed and make it more meaningful to people, the average person in the street. And it's coincidental what happened, which is what I'm doing. Well, I'm doing both ends of things. I've spent the half of this day decoupling radar and all kinds of other data.
Yeah,
you asked me a question. Ken, you asked me a question. I'm giving you an answer. Please quiet, okay? You've asked me the question, and I'm trying to say that I never said that we should charge. Wait a minute. I have authored Friendly Fences, which is a concept of allowing and encouraging everybody who has their own view of what happened on 9/11 to continue their own research and to stop throwing hand grenades across the fence to somebody else. No, you asked me a question, and I'm going to make the point of view.
What question have I asked you?
You asked me how to make your video more accessible to people, and I'm basically saying that the problem is that sometimes our information is too high octane for people to answer.
Let's just squeeze in a comment.
Who else would like to be on the stack to ask Jim a question or make a comment about Jim?
Could I just squeeze in a response to Robin? I didn't mean to imply that Robin didn't care about science and truth. I simply meant that he was emphasizing marketing and politics, making this acceptable to the public. And that's all I was responding to, Robin. I respect all the research you're doing.
Thank you.
This is Steve Dayock. I'd like to
Who else would like to be on the stack?
Steve Dayock.
Steve, and then who else?
Ned.
Steve and Nick, okay.
Ned Delaney.
And who else? Oh, Ned, I'm sorry. And who else? Okay, Steve and then Ned.
Yeah. So am I up?
Yeah, Steve, you're up. Huh?
So, Jim, just a question. At the Vancouver hearings, did they do folks ever really discuss how the gashes were created?
Yeah. You mean the gashes and the facades?
Yeah.
As I was saying, I think that may have been an actual role for nanothermite. They were done beneath a kind of, you know, it was a smoke and mirrors thing. You had this apparent debris initially when they were cutting out or creating those facades. There was a very, very nice piece about this by Christopher Holmes you might want to check out, that began by a very extensive exploration of the gash on the South Tower and exploring how many features were present there that could not have been there if an actual plane had passed through there. There was quite a fair amount of discussion of that. Yes, the answer is yes.
Okay, thank you.
Pursuant to educating the public, and let's say we have an auditorium and we have a guest speaker and 90% of the people agree on the premise presented, you know, at the time. I guess from a sociological standpoint, what percent, if you only have a certain percent of the people that even at that, even though they agree with everything, would be willing to step forward and actually participate. We have a government that's totally adamant about taking any action whatsoever, regardless of what the evidence is, one way or the other, and in many cases actually refuses to even look at even to consider the evidence. And I guess the dilemma that I see is pertaining to a public, regardless of how many people actualize, it goes back to the number of people, for instance, that believe that the 2000 election and 2004 election were both stolen by George Bush in some capacity. The fact that the government itself must take the initiative to rectify, you know, damages that have been done to the country, It tends to trump. I mean, the government is showing that it's trumping populist preferences, you know, all along the mainstream. And I see this as a real dilemma that we have to confront here.
Yeah, it's part and parcel
of the statement.
It's part and parcel of the problem we have in awaiting a government reinvestigation. I mean, you know, we had that with JFK when the HSCA reinvestigated in 77, 78, and finally issued its report, where Robert Blakeney, who was the head of that investigation, played a role similar to that of Philip Zelikow, where Zelikow had a draft of the report done a year before he shared it with any member of the staff, where Blakeney was directing it responsibility to the mob to get it off the back of the CIA and the Navy, the Joint Chiefs, who were equally involved in this thing. I mean, both of them were national security events signed off at the highest levels of the American government. So we're not going to – it explains the delay, 441 days, you know, Bush and Cheney going in together, holding hands, not – testifying under oath, not even allowing their testimony to be recorded by a stenographer. Those are all signs of consciousness of guilt. It's very blatant. It's very obvious. I think the only serious possibility for a real judicial proceeding is an international tribunal. It's not going to happen in the United States. And the lock they have on the American judiciary, especially in New York, through judges like Hellerstein, is simply stunning.
That goes back to the question I had earlier about people affiliated with Silverstein, and basically people of Jewish or Zionist persuasion. That, you know, there's a whole list of people that all seem to be part of a network of some sort.
Yes. Yeah, Zionism is the issue. You know, there are Jews who are not Zionists, or Zionists who aren't Jews. There's a whole Christian Zionist movement that wants us. The Armageddon, the second coming of Christ. I mean, it's unbelievable some of the views that are motivating politics, but there it is, and we have to recognize it and deal with it one way or another.
That's the biggest gift 9/11 Truth Movement can ever give this world, dealing with Zionism. Horton.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, would anyone else like to ask another question, or... anybody hasn't spoken yet, like to ask Jim a question? Wow, I cannot believe that. I thought we'd be here another hour.
Well, I think that, you know, you've given so many links. People now, you know, knowing, having a better understanding of what we discovered, the conclusions we reached at the Vancouver conference, can go through now this list of links I gave and appreciate what they find there and have more information to base, you know, their questions upon when we get together a month from now. I've already sent you four or five links about JFK that should be a suitable background, too.
Right, but plus the summary of the evidence that you've given us today, Jim, I think for people that listen in who weren't here tonight, will probably spark some more discussion too. So
I think
we'll have a pretty full agenda next time, I'll guess. We'll probably be taking up most of the hour.
Does Jim have an email address where we can reach him?
Absolutely. J. Fetzer, J-F-E-T-Z-E-R, at D, for the Duluth campus, .umnuniversityofminnesota.edu, even though I'm not living in Duluth any longer. That's a permanent email address, so that's the way to reach me.
All right, do repeat after the at sign.
At D, as in dog or David, .umn, for universityofminnesota.edu.
Gotcha. Okay, very good. Thank you, Jim.
Uh-huh, my pleasure.
And thank you, Jim, for joining us tonight. Thank everybody for being here and for our cooperation again. And I look forward to the next teleconference, the last Wednesday in January.
Perfect. Good night, everybody. All the questions were excellent. Thank you so much, everyone.
Great. Good night, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Hi.
Jonathan, or, I'm sorry, Craig?